Dr. K in for Mark Steiner here on the Mark Steiner Show. We now turn our attention from Lochte Gate to Louisiana, a state that has been hit by heavy rains. Between October 11th and between August 11th and August 14th, more than 20 inches of rain fell in and around East Baton Rouge, one of the hardest hit parishes. And in some parishes in the region, as much as 2 feet of rain fell in 48 hours. As of Sunday, the floods have killed at least 13 people, and the state government says an estimated 60,000 homes have been damaged, 102,000 people have registered for federal help, and 7,300 local businesses have been shut down. President Obama, who has received heavy criticism for not ending his vacation early to visit there, will be traveling there today. Joining me to talk about it and give us an update are Jordan Flattery. He's an award-winning journalist, producer, and author whose books include Floodlines, Community and Resistance from Katrina to the Jenna. Good morning, Jordan. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well,
thank you. Thanks for having me on, Kay.
Thank you. I also want to mention your newest book, No More Heroes, Grassroots Challenges to the Savior Mentality. Up next is Raymond Jetson. He's the president and CEO of Metromorphosis. Good morning, Raymond. How are you?
Good morning, Kay. I'm well. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And that's a nonprofit organization based in Baton Rouge, correct?
Correct. We are based in Baton Rouge.
Good. We'll get our update from you on the ground of what's happening there. We also have Dr. Andy Miller. He's a professor in the Department of Geography and Environmental Systems with a focus on urban flooding here at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Good morning.
Good morning, Kay. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. If you want to be a part of our conversation, then you can call us at 410-319-8888. You can tweet us at K Whitehead, that's K-A-Y-E Whitehead, or you can visit us on our Facebook page. Jordan, let me start with you. Can you give us an update of what has been happening in Louisiana?
Well, you know, I think, probably our Baton Rouge expert might be the best for that, but I just want to, put this in the context of the overall devastation that we've seen in Louisiana, not just in the last couple of days, but in the last years and decades. You know, we've lost, huge amounts of our coast due to coastal erosion that's made us all more vulnerable to hurricanes in southern Louisiana. We still lose about a football field of land every 45 minutes, and a lot of that is due directly to the oil companies and their pipelines that they've dug. The community of Isle de Jean Charles are now known as the first climate refugees. The entire community of this small little island on the southern coast, which used to be part of the landmass, are having to move. It's a group of indigenous people there because their land is literally underwater. I've been down there, and you talk to people, you see their backyard is water, where when they were kids, it used to be land, and they used to do hunting and walk around there. I think put all of this in the context of climate change is really key. You know, we're having these thousand-year storms more and more frequently, certainly not every thousand years. And nobody's talking about holding the corporations accountable for rebuilding. You know, over the coming months, it's going to take billions of dollars to rebuild these homes. And what you're going to see is a lot of volunteers, the people chip in to help, and you might see some government aid. But, you know, the people that really should be paying for this is the corporations that have caused the climate change that is causing this. You know, people in Baton Rouge, that's also part of, and the areas around there, it's also part of Cancer Alley, right, where we have huge cancer rates because of the corporations down there. And so I think, you know, we really need to look at who's really responsible for this situation, for this devastation. So many people don't have flood insurance. You're going to see a lot of people being blamed for not having flood insurance. But again, let's blame first of all, the economy that doesn't allow people to have the money for it, you know, so it's people with the least money that are going to be getting blamed. And let's blame the situation that causes this unlikely thousand-year storm to happen with huge likelihood. These neighborhoods where people thought they were safe from flooding that are no longer safe because of what's happening by these corporations.
Okay, so now I do appreciate kind of the broader framing. I'm just going to narrow it a little bit and ask you, Raymond, if you can just kind of give us that update from the ground. We see what we're watching on the news, we're watching and reading about what's happening on the internet, but you're there. What is going on the ground?
Well, a couple of things, Kay. First of all, it's on a spectrum. There's a continuum. There are people who were able to get back into their homes as early as the end of last week, and they've gone in, cleaned out all of the remnants of their life that are now destroyed by water and put them on the side of the road. Some have gone in and actually begun to remove the wet sheetrock and other things so that the actual foundation and framing of their home can dry out and they not be contaminated with mold, et cetera. You have some people who, because of the way the water is receding, who are just being able to get into their homes, and so they are literally people today who are having that slap in the face feeling of opening your front door and walking in and seeing everything, all of the things that you possessed in one way or another destroyed by water. And then there are others on the far end who are not yet able to get into their homes because of the way in which the water patterns are receding. And so you have people all along the line. The one thing that they all have in common is that most of their earthly possessions are no longer theirs, or at least they no longer have any use for them. And so when you consider some of the numbers that you mentioned, the 60,000 homes, the 100-plus thousand individuals who have registered for FEMA-related assistance, the 7,500 approximate businesses that are not open and active in commerce today, you're talking about widespread disaster, widespread impact, and people are still in many instances in a state of shock.
Dr. Miller, I want to bring you into the conversation. You had mentioned in our earlier conversation before we came on the air that Louisiana was like a big giant flood basin, and that these type of events are actually going to probably be more common going forward. Can you explain kind of the setup of how Louisiana is prone to floods and then why we might see more of these happening?
Sure. You're looking at a broad coastal plain area that is mostly lowlands and was mostly made over time by the various rivers by sediment that they deposited. So it's an area of pretty low relief, right adjacent to the Gulf of Mexico. You have a pool of very warm water at this time in the summer, which creates atmospheric conditions that favor the kind of conditions that will lead to major flooding. This was a very rare and unusual event, but just as was the case in Katrina in 2005, it was a pool of extraordinarily warm water over the Gulf that caused rapid intensification of that storm. And a pool of very warm water over the Gulf that actually led to the conditions that led to this storm as well. One thing we know is that as the atmosphere gets warmer over time, which is certainly something we're seeing and can anticipate seeing more of in the future, the opportunities for that much water vapor to get into the atmosphere to cause a storm like this will probably increase as well. So when we talk about things like a 1,000-year rainfall, there's a lot of things that go into that, but I would agree that this is not necessarily something that is going to be a 1,000-year recurrence interval. We can anticipate more events like this, even though this is indeed an extraordinarily rare event in terms of our past experience.
Now, Jordan, I want to come back to you because the flooding in Louisiana has raised some questions about timing and urgency of warnings. Do you think more could have been done to help people get prepared, or everything that could have been done was done? Like, what do you think?
You know, I mean, I think, in a sense, what we're looking at in Louisiana is all of our futures. You know, I think, you know, it's just like in New York, nobody thought Hurricane Sandy could come. But, you know, these things are just going to become more and more frequent in all kinds of places. So I think, you know, if you look at the past, you know, we couldn't have predicted what was going to happen in Baton Rouge. Of course, not just Baton Rouge, but in many parishes in Louisiana, they got this flooding. But, you know, now more and more places that didn't have flooding in the past are going to see flooding in the future. And so, you know, this is our future. A lot of people that think that they're safe are no longer safe. And I think that's going to change a lot of calculations. It's going to change where we think is a flood zone, where we think is not a flood zone. And we're going to have to start thinking who's going to be responsible for us, because we're going to have a lot of communities that don't have flood insurance. That need help rebuilding. It's going to happen more and more frequently, And the question is going to come, you know, is the government responsible? Are corporations responsible? Are taxpayers responsible? And so I think we need to have these struggles. You know, while we directly try and help the people on the ground now, we have to have a systemic fight over what this means. What do we do when there's a disaster? What do we do when we see this rebuilding? And, you know, I lived in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina and been living there for the 11 years since. And, you know, I think that the pain that your last guest talked about is so important to keep in mind. You know, it just doesn't end. You know, you walk in and you see all your possessions gone. And 11 years later, you're still missing those possessions. Mm-hmm. There's still that hole in your heart where they're gone. And it takes a lot to make that right. It takes a lot to rebuild your life after that, and things are never really the same after that. And, you know, people are going to need not just rebuilding help, but trauma help, you know, especially for the kids that grew up in this. You know, one other thing I want to say, it is just an embarrassment of our media that we have, you know, so many media companies, and yet they did not come. And, you know, you mentioned Obama not coming. We could talk about whether or not that's a good or bad idea and whether that draws resources. But it's definitely a tragedy that the media were ignoring. And they were so, as usual, you know, obsessed with what's Donald Trump saying today, and also, you know, covering the Olympics. And,
right.
And they ignored this massive disaster happening once again after Katrina. You know, I think the media said, oh, well, you know, we'll never ignore this kind of thing again. And then they did it again.
If you just joined us, I'm talking with Jordan Flattery, Raymond Jetson, and Dr. Andy Miller about the flooding in Louisiana. And if you want to join our conversation, you can join us at 410-319-8888. We do have a call on the line. Austin, welcome to the Mark Steiner Show. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
First of all, I just want to say thanks, y'all, for covering this really important story. There's definitely a feeling down here like, you know, we've been hearing from our friends and family in other locations that they're not really hearing reports of how serious things are down here. So thank you.
So I know that you're a friend of Mark Steiner, so we welcome you back to the show, but that you've had experience with gutting houses in Louisiana. Can you talk about that just a little bit?
Sure. You know, in the last week, you know, it's real urgent right now to get these houses cleaned out, get the furniture and the carpets and the drywall out, because it's 95 degrees and humid down here, and mm-hmm. if you're not on that soon, it's going to be a total loss. You know, I'm in fact standing in front of my coworker's house right now, looking down this block. Every single house has just mountains of furniture, drywall, just rotting in the sun. And you know, I have no idea how many houses we got gutted this last weekend, but there's tens of thousands left to do.
Oh, thank you so much, Austin, and the work you're doing. Yes, Raymond, I was going to ask you if you can chime in as well.
Yeah, there are a couple of pieces. First of all, thanks so much to the gentleman who called in for his on the ground work. Meeting the real needs of people, because that is of essence and critical at this point. But I would like to return to the conversation that was about the systemic nature of this and the need for a much broader perspective. Yes, there are thousands upon thousands of people who are profoundly impacted here. But there are some things here which will befuddle the typical national response. Part of it is the whole issue around flood insurance. One of the issues that was really prevalent and that will be really prevalent here is the number of people who lost all of their possessions living in areas that were not a part of a floodplain. And so they were not required to have flood insurance. I also serve as the pastor of a local congregation. Mm. I have 135 families to date who have been impacted by the flood. Most of them did not have flood insurance. I had one lady I spoke with who's lived in her home for 50 years and never flooded. So why would she have flood insurance? Mm. And so I think that there is a larger conversation about water management, some of the commerce-related decisions that we've made, some of the development issues that we've made, some of the things that we've not done in terms of how we manage the flow of water and how we respect the natural flow of things, if you will. And so that is a much larger conversation that needs to happen. Unfortunately, the tension between that larger conversation is the number of people who literally don't have anything other than the clothes on their back. And so that's the tension, and that is the challenge that we face. And the last thing that I will say is that please don't miss that you have this huge disaster, all of the aftermath that will result from that, and all of this huge federal and international response that is being overlaid on an already very fragile community. This has been a powerful summer in Baton Rouge, from the death of Alton Sterling to the killing of the police officers, the awaiting a decision on the charges against that there was already tension in the atmosphere. And now you bring all of this on top of that. And so how does the community maintain its collective equilibrium to deal with all of this at one time? And so the final thing I'll say is the point about trauma and responding to it and making certain that people receive some type of mental health support is a really critical issue.
I want to ask Dr. Miller, because I know you do a lot of work with urban flooding. Can you connect this for us to Ellicott City? Because for some people, when they think of flooding here in Baltimore City, Louisiana is a far stretch, but they are thinking of what happened when I think the main street of Ellicott City got wiped out. Can you just talk a bit about that?
Sure. And let me just say a word first about Louisiana. And this storm as it compares even with Katrina.
Okay.
So this storm dropped about three times as much rain on Louisiana as Katrina did.
Wow.
Katrina was largely a storm surge flood. This was a no-name storm. One of the issues around this storm is that the Weather Service issued lots of warning, but the media didn't pick up on it because there wasn't that radar image of a you know, cyclone coming in across the South Atlantic and into the Gulf.
Now, I want to ask you very quickly, because you just said it was a no-name storm. I've seen that in articles. What exactly does that mean,
a
no-name storm?
If a storm is an intense enough low-pressure system, it becomes first a tropical cyclone, and then it can be graduate to a hurricane if the low pressure is low enough and the wind velocity around it is high enough. So hurricanes are very dramatic. They get a lot of attention. This was a storm that it was a low-pressure system, huge amount of water in the atmosphere. It sucked in this vortex, a lot of moisture that kept coming in from the southwest corner over the Gulf, and it just slowly drifted over the landscape. But it was not one that was dramatic in terms of the radar images, although it was predicted. And it dropped. It also dropped as much rain in 3 days as fell over Los Angeles between January of 2012 and August of 2016.
Wow.
So I think Watson, Louisiana had over 31 inches of rain. So it was an extraordinary event. The highest rainfall intensities were on the order of 6 inches per hour.
Wow.
So an extremely rare event, but it's ultimately controlled by the atmospheric conditions that could recur. Now, in Ellicott City, we had a very different kind of urban flood. I mean, in Baton Rouge, you have an urban flood that's generated by just an unbelievable amount of water over an extended period of time. And you are going to get flooding, even of places that are outside of what is mapped by FEMA as the 100-year floodplain, because areas that are just a little bit higher than that do and can get flooded in these rare events. In Ellicott City, you have a situation where you did have also extraordinarily intense rainfall, but in a very short period of time. So there was one gauge that recorded something like 4.5 inches of rain in 1 hour. There was a maximum of maybe as much as 8 inches. And in Ellicott City, you're looking at a place where it's almost like a narrow bowl that's draining a very steep area. And the intensity of the rain in a short period of time, combined with the infrastructure and the location of the town, which was a mill town placed on a creek and built on top of a creek, it was almost inevitable that Ellicott City would and will continue to get flooded. One of the things I do want to point out when we talk about these extraordinary rainfall amounts is we refer to things as a 1,000-year storm, and it's somewhat of a misnomer. But that's based on probabilities of a certain amount of rain happening in a certain amount of time at a point on the map.
Okay.
That's different from over a whole watershed, and it's different from the conditions that can actually lead to flooding. So I would estimate in Ellicott City, it was a rare event, but I would say you're going to see more floods. It might have been, maybe, in my estimation, maybe a 50 to 100-year flood. We don't have enough records to say for sure. The flooding is, extreme floods are much more common than what you hear in the media when they start throwing around 1 in 1,000-year rainfall, and it's very important for the public to understand.
Jordan and Raymond, I want you both to kind of comment on this, and I'll start with Jordan. Talk about the Obama effect for us. The fact that he did not come, the fact that he, of course, criticized Bush earlier, Bush 2, for flying over, the fact that with him not showing up, you also didn't have the media kind of flocking to this with the attention of either Trump or the Olympics. Do you think that was a good decision? Should the president have cut his vacation short and come there earlier? Jordan, I'll start with you.
Well, two things. First of all, I think the media needs to be able to know what an emergency is, what a situation is, and they shouldn't have to have Obama come for them to pay attention, right? So I don't want to let the media off the hook by blaming Obama. I think, you know, whether he came or not, you know, I think I think we can argue about that. You know, there's those that say that drains resources. I mean, maybe he should have come, but he also could have just been speaking out about it sooner. But I think over the coming weeks, that's when we really see, you know, what's he going to be saying over the coming weeks. You know, one thing to look for, Monique Hardin of Advocates for Environmental Human Rights, she talked about after Hurricane Katrina, then President Bush came, and he came, you know, rolled up his sleeves and was at a volunteer site. And in a way, that was a good photo op, but the message that was really sending was the government was not really going to be taking responsibility for the disaster. Instead, it was going to be up to volunteers, right? So it was encouraging people to volunteer. And so, you know, I think what we need to be looking for in the coming months from the government is the government taking responsibility for rebuilding, or are they pushing this responsibility onto the backs of volunteers? And, you know, volunteerism is great, and people can do a lot, you know, with, you know, helping to gut houses and communities coming together. But this is a massive billions of dollars effort, and volunteers is not enough. And, you know, this is, the media, again, is going to be looking away in a couple of weeks, but this is going to take years to rebuild. And so what is the role the government is going to take over the coming not just days and not just weeks and not just months and not just years? And so the question to ask is, what role does President Obama, you know, play in these coming weeks of making clear that the government is not going to abandon people? And one more thing I just want to say is to look at the disaster, the disaster before the disaster, right? People in North Baton Rouge were making 47 cents to the dollar compared to people in the rest of Baton Rouge. You know, this was, you know, that area particularly was an impoverished area beforehand. So, you know, what are we doing about the economic situation of that area overall? You know, in some ways, this flood highlights the disaster before the disaster, the racist divisions, the economic divisions that already existed.
Okay. And Raymond, if you could help us first to understand your position on the Obama effect, and then what you think could be done. Is it pushing it on the government? Is it pushing on the backs of volunteers? But if you could just kind of speak about that for us.
Okay. First, the very distinguished professor, as so many others, first of all, referred to this as a no-name storm, and I appreciate him highlighting that and the meaning of that. I will just say to you and to the professor, there are a lot of folks in South Louisiana who've given it a few names over the last few
days. Only imagine.
Yes, they've given it a number. I've heard it referred to as a number of different things over the last few days. As it relates to President Obama, I have not heard a single conversation about whether President Obama should or should not have come to Baton Rouge that was not rooted in a political discussion.
Okay.
That was not a single recovery, rescue, disaster-related conversation that argued that President Obama should or should not come.
Okay.
I served as the CEO of the Louisiana Family Recovery Corps post-Katrina. I was the Deputy Secretary of the State Department of Health and Hospitals when Katrina struck New Orleans. Based on my experiences, the FEMA response, Jay Johnston was in town literally within moments of this storm. The FEMA apparatus responded in a profoundly different way than in the aftermath of Katrina. And there was constant communication between the governor's office and the White House as it related to the storm. And so what was most important about people and their recovery was happening. Could the president have spoken out and called attention to it? Certainly. It would have been wonderful. But nobody here, as they were driving boats down streets to get people, was wondering about where the president was. And so that's the issue that's my perspective on it. The last thing that I will say is the comment about what existed in North Baton Rouge before the storm. It's certainly in line with my earlier comments about the tension that existed in this city beforehand. As a matter of fact, in the op-ed piece that I recently wrote, my concern is that when the waters recede, the issues of geography, economics, and race will still be before us. And as a community, we were not too thoughtful in addressing those issues before the storm. And so in the midst of all of this, why would anyone be led to believe that we're going to be any more equipped to do it? The illusion of community that this storm has created is, I think, more difficult, makes it even more difficult, because simply because we were all willing to jump into the same boat to save our lives, it would be a terrible mistake to assume that that means that we are all on the same page in terms of people's value and place in this community.
Well, we're going to take a quick break here. Stay with us. With Jordan Flaherty, Raymond Jessen, and Dr. Andy Miller, we're going to pick up on our conversation about the flooding in Louisiana. Owusu, stay with us. We're going to get to your phone call right when we come back. Mark Steiner Show. This is Dr. K here on WEAA 88.9 FM. I want to thank you so much, Jordan Flaherty, for joining us in the last hour talking about the flooding in Louisiana. The conversation was just so engaging. We had so many questions. We wanted to continue for just a little bit longer. So we're still joined by Raymond Jessen, President and CEO of Metromorphosis. Raymond, if I'm not mistaken, you are on the ground in Baton Rouge, correct?
Yes, I am.
Good. We also have Dr. Andy Miller here. He's a professor in the Department of Geography and Environmental Systems with a focus on urban flooding at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Thank you. Welcome back. I want to let you know that the Rise of Charm City is looking for funding for a second season. They are in the last 6 days of their fundraising. They're looking to raise money to produce 12 more episodes focusing on generational stories in Baltimore. To donate, go to Indiegogo.com and search Rise of Charm City and follow them on Twitter at Rise of Charm City to get more information. So let's just get back into our conversation here. We had Owusu standing by with a question. He's in Baton Rouge right now. Good morning, Owusu.
Good morning to all of your guests. I agree with Reverend Jessen's statement that as far as President Obama, what's done on the ground is a lot more important than the cameos. And the governor here had no problem with the president not coming. Others have stated that they could have added to the confusion in terms of the security situation. But the governor also stated that he had access to the White House right away, that the disaster was declared right away, so he was satisfied. On a personal level, I live between two subdivisions, both of which received a lot of damage. One in particular, most of the houses, it seems like, were very, very serious. And my son, on a personal level, was completely flooded out. He did get to his house by boat. There were water moccasins in the house. And ironically, he's called to duty on FEMA, but he's stationed now in Texas rather than in the Baton Rouge area. One of my concerns is for the renters. My concern is also for the homeowners as well, because of the lack of flood insurance. They will get some assistance with FEMA, but there's going to be a very critical housing shortage. So I'm really concerned what's going to happen to all the folks who don't own houses, but will be displaced.
Thank you so much, Owusu. Raymond, if I can have you respond to that, if you can, what do you think is going to happen if people are not able to get the assistance they need? They don't have the flood insurance in place. They don't have savings, built up. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, so I think that, your caller's distinction between two disparate groups is a very significant one. Homeowners, even if they did not have flood insurance, can, I think, still anticipate some effort to, if not make them whole, to at least close the gap a bit between what they are able to secure for their home and what they need. And I don't want to give the impression that everybody's going to receive everything they need to build their home, rebuild their home. That's just not the case. I think the prickly issue of the widespread absence of flood insurance in this disaster is still one of those very critical systemic issues that the state and the federal government is going to have to negotiate, both through the White House, through the disaster apparatus, and through congressional action. But I think that there will be some effort, albeit at the end of the day, a short one that's not as comprehensive as necessary, there will be some effort to address the needs of homeowners. The critical population, as your caller made reference to, projections at this point are that somewhere between 25% and 30% of the people who were who are displaced by this disaster were renters. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we know from the experience with Katrina is that renters oftentimes ended up on the very short end of the stick here. First and foremost, there is an absence of affordable rental stock for them to move into. The area that was flooded, probably 6-7 blocks away from where the church I serve is located, contained a significant body of the rental stock in terms of houses as well as apartment complexes. And all of those are gone today. And so those individuals who are either in the homes of family, friends, or in the shelters that are being staffed by the Red Cross, they don't have any place to go back to. And the rental stock that was available has been largely taken by the homeowners who need somewhere to stay while they are repairing their home and who have the resources to pay for an apartment while they are getting their home repaired. And so there's going to be a huge a lack of affordable rental. But then that's not the end of the negative impact on the renting community, because once the homeowners or the owners of the rental stock get their money from insurance and government and repair these properties, it is very unlikely that the people who formerly lived there will be able to rent them for the same thing that they rented them for before the storm. And so it's a huge quagmire that I don't know that anybody has been able to solve effectively. There were some efforts after Katrina, but they were clunky, were not really responsive to the needs of people, and were more focused on the property owners than the people who lived in them.
Well, Dr. Miller, I want to ask you, you had said earlier that we're likely to see these type of storms and floodings as we go forward. So what should people do to get prepared? Can you do anything at all outside of just getting more flood insurance?
It's a difficult question, because a lot of people, even who lived within the zone that might be within the 100-year floodplain, couldn't afford to get flood insurance. Mm-hmm. And there's a huge social issue here, because flooding is the most common natural hazard, and it affects many, many people over time. I don't know. I don't live in Louisiana, so I'm not familiar so much with the circumstances, except that I can look at the topography and tell you what any hydrologist would tell you, which is that it is going to be flood prone in much of that region.
But pushing it a little bit, because you look at Louisiana, I'm also thinking Ellicott City. I mean, you know,
Ellicott City is another story. They're going to rebuild Ellicott City because it's a historic district.
Okay.
It's built on top of a stream.
Okay.
So I'm not quite sure exactly what they could do to protect those properties. I'm sure there's some things they could do to protect them a bit better.
But they're going to recover
quickly.
But,
you know, if you're living right on a stream, you can expect that things are going to get wet. And every now and then, it'll be really extreme like it was in this event.
Okay.
One of the things I can say is that Congress is going to have to take some responsibility over time for recognizing the scope of these kinds of disasters and recognizing the huge number of people who are vulnerable, and figuring out some way above and beyond what our existing legal structures are. even when you look at a flood map, it's based on probabilities. There's a lot of uncertainty about exactly, you know, they have to draw a line on the map and say you're inside or outside the 100-year floodplain. The reality is if we did that on a probabilistic basis, that line could have a lot of variability in where you draw it. And yes, it's a legal document and it affects a lot of policy. We need to recognize that the risks are out there. They're going to get greater, and we need a national policy to try to figure out what to do about this. And I'm not blaming FEMA. They do whatever they can with the resources they have. But things like not recognizing climate change as a reality certainly don't help the situation.
Raymond, very quickly before we go to break to begin our next segment, I just want to ask you, if people wanted to help, what can they do?
At this point, monetary donations to help people clean out their homes is the most effective. People certainly will need clothes eventually. There was this typical onslaught of well-meaning and very generous gifts of clothing and other things. But toiletries, I mean, people will still need soap and underwear and baby formula and diapers. And so finding local entities and contributing those. But at this point, people are going to need finances to support their efforts to get their homes back in place.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Dr. Andy Miller, joining us from UMBC. Thank you, Raymond Jetson, joining us from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Stay with us. When we come back after our short break, we will discuss mindfulness and criminal justice. How do we practice it, and what does it mean? We want to hear from you. Please feel free to call 410-319-8888 or send me a tweet at Kay Whitehead. Stay with us.